Okay. So, just in case you're wondering, yes, I am recording. I figure I'll put the audio for the lectures online, so if anyone who misses it can do that, but I think in general it's probably easier to understand what's going on if you're actually here, because trying to capture what I do, I normally write on the board a lot, so, yeah. Anyway, in this very warm room, SA 518, Southern 518, you're in Comp 2406. This is the Fundamentals of Web Applications. This is the second time this course is being offered ever. Thus, as a result, I am not as clueless as I was teaching it the first time through, but I wouldn't say I have a complete clue. So still, I would consider this course a bit experimental. I've completely changed the organization and structure of the course, and hopefully things will go better, because we always want improvements. Anyway, so just to do the basics here, Monday, Wednesday, 2:30 to 4, lecture, 2:30, 5 minutes past, 5 minutes before. My name's Anil Somayaji. I have many email addresses. If you're talking about class-related stuff, I suggest using my anilsomayaji@connect.carleton.ca address. Interesting to see when they move the faculty off of Connect and onto Cmail, but for now it's still Connect. But that email account of mine gets much less traffic than the others, so you're less likely to get lost. So my office hours are Tuesday and Wednesday. No office hours this week, because after lecture I'm going to my office, gathering my stuff, and getting on an airplane for Calgary and then to Banff. So I'm at Banff Tuesday through Thursday, so I will not have office hours this week. Please do not look for me. You can email me. I'll probably check in the evenings, but otherwise. We do have class on Wednesday, and we do have tutorial on Friday. Wednesday, Anne Fry will come in. She is one of your TAs, and she will talk to you about cryptography and email cryptography, i.e. how to secure your email. And the reason why I'm having her talk about this is for two reasons. One, it's actually relevant for this class because if you don't understand the basics of public key cryptography, you don't understand secure websites. And I would, at the later in this term, like to discuss that. And the second reason is, darn it, you all should know how to encrypt your email. And I'm kind of tired of you all not knowing how to do this. So let's cover it here. So Annie will cover that in lecture, and that material will also show up later in the term. That's Wednesday. And then the other TA is Michael Bingham. So his office hours are Monday 12 to 2, and Annie's is Thursday 2 to 4. So the tutorials are Friday, 11:30 to 1. Website, if you find this, it's this URL. It's a big pain. Easiest way to find this web page is just to go to homeostasis.ses.carleton.ca/wiki. If you download the virtual machine images that you... So, I try to think. I think I recognize a lot of you from tutorial on Friday. Yes, there was a tutorial already. If you missed the tutorial, it's okay, but you should talk to a TA that you missed the tutorial, because you need to do the stuff that's in the tutorial, which is getting your basic environment up. And I will talk about that in a little bit. So basics, know where you are. So here's a little official course description. I wrote this, so I hope I can teach it. An introduction to internet application development that emphasizes the computer science fundamentals of the technologies underlying web applications. Topics include scripting and functional languages, language-based virtual machines, database query languages, remote procedure calls over the internet, and performance and security concerns in modern distributed applications. So, fundamentals of web applications. Covering this, what sort of things that you associate with the web is not in that list? Yes. Graphics? Is HTML on that list? No. Is CSS on that list? No. Will we be touching on HTML and CSS? Yes. I expect you all to go
and learn about those sort of technologies on your own. There are how many different tutorials online for how you learn basic HTML and basic CSS? It's all stuff that as second-year computer science students you should be able to learn in your sleep. It's not hard. It is not worth my time spending going through all the details. I can explain to you the basics of an HTML structure, and I will talk about that. But for the details, you go and learn it on your own. What I will be teaching you about is JavaScript. That was the thing that we will spend a good amount of time talking about. But now, will I be talking about all the details of JavaScript? No, because in so many ways, JavaScript is just like Java, it's just like C, it's just another programming language. What I'm going to talk about is how it's different than the programming languages you've covered up to this point. Because JavaScript is the language of the web. Have any of you tried browsing the web without JavaScript enabled? Have you ever just tried? Does it work very well? Everything breaks. It used to be that people said, oh, I want to be secure on the internet, so I'm going to say turn off JavaScript. It's not even worth your time. Nothing works. And this should give you pause, because the web was originally designed to say, oh, I'm going to look at documents inside of a web browser. That's not what you're doing. You're running programs inside of your web browser. Your web browser is a programming language runtime environment which has legacy support for showing documents. So that's what we're going to talk about, is the web as a programming environment, because it is the premier programming environment that is used today for new applications. So, how are you going to learn these skills? So the structure of the course is, first we've got a midterm and final. So together that's 60% of your grade. 25%, 35%. So, yeah, you should show up and do well on those. So the rest of this is all about preparing you for that 60%. And the way you get prepared for that 60% is you show up in tutorial and you do the assignments. And the assignments, there's only going to be 4 assignments. If you... You know, let's say you're having a busy week. You say, oh, I don't need to do that assignment. Well, the midterm and final are going to be heavily based upon the assignments. Let me just say I believe in recycling and leave it at that. In other words, if you skip an assignment or don't seriously pay attention to it, you're potentially blowing half of the midterm or a quarter of your final. Don't blow off the assignments. But this also means don't get stressed out over little portions of the assignments. This will be the first run of these assignments. Some parts of them will be able to seem really easy. Other parts of the assignment may seem really hard. Try to understand as much as you can. Do it not for the purpose of maximizing your grade. It's only 5% each one of these things. Let's say you just turn something in and have some sort of answer for all of the questions. You're probably going to get half credit. Now, you might say, well, I can just collaborate with my friends and like 4 of us can sit there and do parts of the assignment. We can all put our things together and we have a great one and turn it in and get all marks. There's just one problem with that. Well, 2 problems. One is you're not going to learn the parts you didn't do. And you're going to screw yourself in the midterm and final. The second thing is, you might get in trouble with me. Because, let me explain my collaboration policy. Collaboration on all work is allowed except for the midterm and final exams.
So we can't collaborate when we're doing the exam?
No. Sorry. During the final exam, there are proctors. It's closed book. You just got to do what's in your head. Midterm, same thing. They are not group midterms. Sorry. Individual work. But you can, up to that, you can work together as much as you want. But what you submit has to be your own. Do not go around and try doing your assignments by setting up, splitting up the responsibilities. Say, you do questions 1 through 3, you do questions 4 through 6 and stuff, and then just put the answers together and send it in. That does you a disservice, and it's dishonest. The best way to ensure this is get together in groups. Talk about the questions. Discuss it. But don't send any files around. Don't share any code. Don't share answers. Talk about it. Because then, when you talk about it, then you have to internalize it and then gather. Because remember, each of these assignments is only 5%. But you mess this up, you're putting, you know, potentially half your grade on, you know, well, 60% of your grade is writing on these assignments. So you could say it logically that each assignment is, you know, the 5% gets leveraged to 15% of your final grade. So it's a learning exercise. If we start seeing serious problems with people, you know, turning in verbatim answers that are repeated across questions and stuff like that, that looks like this, I have no compunctions on sending stuff to the dean, and it'll be up to them to deal with it. That's the basic policy for plagiarism at Carleton. Sometimes professors do things individually, differently, but the policy is a professor suspects something, they gather the evidence, and they send it to the dean. And the reason why it gets done that way is because then I don't have to decide exactly how strict or not how to be, and also that means they can detect patterns. But what they'll do to you, you don't. It's not pleasant. Official process of this sort of thing is not fun. I don't like praying to paperwork, but I'm happy to do it if I start seeing this because it really ticks me off. So don't do it. That's about one of the few things you can really do to get on my bad side. So just do the work. Be better for you. Better for me. So, it's that. Communication. My wiki is your friend. Visit the wiki. We'll have all the things. So the wiki is up. See, you learn is kind of not there. It will be up soon. That will be where you'll submit your assignments. That will also be your grade book, but there won't be much in the way of content. Because, I'm sorry, it's painful. I have hope for it being better in the future. It's open source, it's based on Moodle, it's all great, but it makes my eyes hurt. So I try to use it as little as possible. But there is a discussion forum there. I have in the past used the discussion forum with Piazza. Have you all used that in other classes? Did you like it? I mean, setting it up is not hard, but in the past I've had people say that, could you open the door back there? Sorry, that door got closed. It is hot in here. So the question is it worth having another login to have a nicer web interface for discussions? If I do that, now one thing, if I do Piazza, then I can also do things like you have your smartphone and you can do polls and stuff. Which, I mean, for a class this size, I don't find is quite so necessary because I can kind of see if you guys are paying attention or not. So. But we might want to try some of that. So quick question. I'll do a quick poll. Who here doesn't care about this? They will be happy with See You Learn or Piazza. Just tell me what to do, and I just don't care. Okay. How many of you would be excited about Piazza? How many of you would prefer, please just let me use See You Learn? Okay.
Okay. Well,
I'll think about it. Right now, we'll say See You Learn, and if I get too annoyed with it, we might switch. So, we've done this. So, textbooks. So, I have two required textbooks. One is JavaScript, The Good Parts by Douglas Crawford, and the other one is Learning Node by Shelley Powers. You should have both of these. They are both in the bookstore. You do not need to have the paper copies. You can have ebook copies. There are sales that go on. I think they might even have a sale, you know, sometimes for the e-copies of these textbooks periodically. And you can get them online in various forms. If you really don't want to deal with the textbooks, you just want to use other online resources, that's fine. But these books are not expensive.
How much are we talking?
Like $20 each. So, and they're not on sale. I have to check. I might have a for sale coupon. Now, if I do, I'll post it. But it's worth your time to get these books, because these books are not big concept. These are so. How many of you are familiar with O'Reilly as a publisher? Okay, so O'Reilly technical books are great. They're not particularly academic. These are more, you know, trade kind of things, but they're in general very well written. For any other publisher, I'll look at their books. I kind of like, oh, do I want it stuff? If it's an O'Reilly book, I'll basically say it's probably going to be a good book. Won't necessarily be the best one, but it'll probably be pretty good. So these are both O'Reilly imprints. And what's nice is if you buy the electronic copies, if you buy them, they don't have any DRM. And they come in multiple formats. So it's EPUB, PDF, and stuff. So you can put them on whatever device you want. And if you really feel cheap, you want to try doing this, sign up for an Safari Books online account, which has a free trial period of so many weeks. So you can kind of just sort of look around and then just look at it online through there. So if you don't want to actually pay for the books yet, you might want to just look at them online, look at them there. And you can actually access that through our library. Our library does have a subscription to Safari Books. But it only allows like 4 concurrent users. So I wouldn't suggest that as your primary resource. So you should expect to be looking at other texts, other documentation on web stuff throughout the term, but these are the two ones I want you to really read. I want you to sit down and go through it because they have a lot of... the JavaScript, The Good Parts... This will actually let you understand JavaScript as a nice programming language. And Learning Node, it just walks you through a lot of stuff for understanding Node. And I'll explain what Node is in a bit. For those of you who have been in tutorial, you've now experienced it. So
I've got some other resources on JavaScript Node, and expect this section to get bigger as we talk about other technologies throughout the term. So in terms of schedule, real quick, I've got all the things here. So we've got 10 lectures, including this one, until we get to the midterm. And then we have a midterm review. And then October 21st, we have the midterm scheduled. So notice that October 14th, I believe, is Thanksgiving. And so you have Thanksgiving, we have the review, and then you have the midterm. And what's really interesting this year is with the fall break, it breaks things up in a rather weird way because of that whole week we're missing, which is the last week of October. So
the midterm review, you know, midterm, we have a lecture, and then there's fall break. So basically, I have a lecture prep it, and this lecture probably I'll spend a lot of time talking about the midterm and probably talking about the assignment that's going to be due next week later. Then there's
another... Basically, lecture 12 through lecture 22, so another 10 lectures, and then final exam during the exam period. Yes?
Are the final exams cumulative or no?
Cumulative. Which is what you want. Well, it's actually impossible to do a non-cumulative final exam for a course like this. It's not like there's separate topics. It all connects. So I'll explain the tutorials in a second, but the tutorials are every week, basically every Friday. I think I've got all the right ones here. And then we have 4 assignments, the first of which will be due September 26th. That assignment should come out within the next week. So by early next week, I'm guessing it'll probably come out by next Wednesday. So the plan is to give you at least 2 weeks for each assignment. the university policies, this kind of standard thing. So accommodations. I'm happy to do any sort of accommodations. I'm in general flexible with things. You know, life intervenes. Things happen. So, you know, you treat me with respect, I'll treat you with respect. You know, I'm not, I see no reason to be a hard ass about various things. But give me notice, you know, give me documentation. You know, if something medical comes up, if you need to, you know, have some sort of special accommodation for your midterm or final, let me know. Particularly let me know for the PMC stuff, because I need to book things in advance. And so it makes it much easier if I know that, so I can book it, that it all goes smoothly. So the tutorials. The tutorials are all required. What that means is it's not necessarily that you have to show up every Friday. In general, you should show up every Friday. I'm not taking attendance in lecture. We will, in effect, be taking attendance in tutorial. But if you cannot make it to a Friday, what you do is you meet with the a TA in the following week before the next tutorial and show them that you've done the work that's required. So the basic format of the tutorials will be similar to this first one, except more involved. This first one was a very simple one. This was kind of your Hello World tutorial. And the idea of this tutorial was just to get your environment up and running, because this is the environment you're going to be using all term. Every one of these tutorials will be very practical exercises where you're just going to get to get some technologies working, play with some code, see what's going on. The idea is that all this stuff we talk about with doing the assignments and stuff, it's very simple things often cause problems. It's like, I don't know how to get this running. Where is it? You know, and the tutorial is the place where we make sure that you have the basic understanding of what's going on. And that's also where we can kind of gauge whether, you know, we're not covering certain material and I can adjust my lectures appropriately. So if you haven't done this tutorial, you should do it. If you have done it, you realize it's pretty darn easy. So questions before I start actually talking about material in terms of structure and things. We good? Then I'm going to turn off the screen. Okay. How are we doing? Okay, good. And, oh, how old-fashioned. But it works. There is no special lighting for the top board. So, node. Oh, man. And that's my one piece of chalk. Okay. Sorry, it's going to be a little faint here. Let's see if I can do something about that next time. So to understand what node is, you have to understand what it's not, which is, we should talk a little bit about what the classic, when we talk about the web, where did the web start? So what you have your browser. Can you read that at all?
Sort of.
I'm not used to having one piece of chalk and having it be bad. Okay, let's
scroll to the board.
Yeah, I think so. It might not have been cleaned properly, but okay. So you have your browser and you have your server. Right?
talk to your web browser talks to a web server. What do they communicate through?
HTTP.
Yes. So there is a protocol called HTTP. Hypertext Transport Protocol. Or Transfer Protocol. I think it's Transfer or Transport. Is it Transfer? I don't know. I look it up. But so HTTP is the name of the protocol for sending things. Now, of course, if we're... We can talk about this more later about what's underneath this. When we say HTTP, there's actually multiple protocols, as there always are. We've shown it down. Really, there's HTTP, which is on top of TCP, which is on top of IP, which typically will be on top of Ethernet, slash some Wi-Fi, slash Sonnet, or depending on how far you're going, it'll be all kinds of transport level technologies. And then there's the internet protocol on top of that, and there's a transmission control protocol on top of that, and on top of that is HTTP. Why am I mentioning this now? Well, in general, when you talk about networks, it's always good to know you're not just talking one thing, you're talking multiple things, and in fact, problems at these levels can influence this. HTTP is a stream. It can text or binary, but it's a stream of data. This is separate from things like IP, which is a packet-based protocol, which means that discrete chunks of information, up to about 1,500 bytes, typically, are exchanged at the IP level. TCP turns these discrete packets into a continuous stream by saying, okay, well, here's your first packet. Here's your second packet. Oh, we lost the third packet. Resend, please. Now here's a fourth packet. Here's a fifth packet. It controls the resending, the ordering of all these packets so it can deal with various issues and how the packets get to the level, get to the network. HTTP takes this basic byte stream provided by TCP and puts syntax on it. So the thing to know about the internet is there used to be lots of different kinds of protocols for transmitting information across the internet. For various reasons, most of those are dead. There really are only two protocols that are used for most things in terms of actually sending information around the internet. The two protocols are HTTP and SMTP. Anyone know what SMTP is for? Mail. Simple mail transfer protocol. Most of the real data that is sent on the internet is either email or web traffic. Everything is encoded in these protocols. HTTP is a very simple protocol. We'll talk in later lectures, we'll talk about the structure of it, but it's really designed for retrieving documents. Saying, what does the browser send the server over HTTP first?
GET requests?
Well, it sends a GET. Well, it sends a request for what? A GET request, what are you asking for?
A resource?
No, a URL.
Right.
So the browser's got a URL here. And this gets put into typically a GET request. There's a few other requests that can be done, but it's basically, give me this URL. And this URL gets sent over the link, and the server figures out, interprets the URL, and then sends back a response. What's it send back? The classic thing is an HTML document. You type into your browser, you've got a URL, http://www.google.com. You enter that into your browser,
get sent over HTTP as a GET request to the web server at Google, one of their 1.2 million machines talking to you or so. That machine then sends back
an HTML document for your browser to interpret. This is the classic structure of a web, of the web. And notice there's almost implicitly in this notion of a file. I mean, really, you think of this URL, it's this string, which really looks like a file name, and you're sending it to the server, and so you're getting a document, which is a file, and then that's sent back. And that is how classic web servers work. They get URLs in, they parse them, they say, what file does this refer to? Am I allowed to send out this file? Yes, here's the file, send it back. That's not really the kind of web server we're going to be talking about in this class. Because that web server is mostly dead. It's there as a special case. It's used for still serving things like images or things like, but even like things like video and stuff, they aren't served that way, really. And certainly most of your documents aren't served that way. So now the question is, why not? What else do you want to do that you can't do by just sending a document? Give me an example that does not fit into this model at all well.
League of Legends,
yeah. But I actually haven't played League of Legends. It's a bad web game. It's an MMO?
It's a massive multiplayer online battle arena. So okay. It's 3v3 or 5v5. Arena matches between players.
Does it require a Flash plugin?
It's an application.
I'm talking about things you run in a browser. So it may use. I don't know if League of Legends might not use. I mean, I'm not sure what protocol. It might probably still use HTTP as its protocol.
It's online. You do have at least four other people, or at least two other people, fighting with you in it.
Yeah. But you're using a custom client. Yeah, so that's not quite the classic web application. Even though it may use web technologies, in fact, you look at a lot of these things, they're still doing HTTP, even if it's a custom application. And I can talk about why that is later. But I'm thinking of things like Gmail or Outlook Mail. YouTube, yes, except for the Flash plugin part, which is kind of going away, but not yet.
You can't have things update right away.
Exactly. So the biggest problem. So in this model, the document used to be able to have embedded JavaScript. So there's little snippets of JavaScript inside of the HTML document. And the reason this was originally done was to make the web page more interesting. So you can have a drop-down menu so that you can notice when you move the mouse over a part of the page. So it was still a document, but it was an interactive document. But that would all happen on the browser side. It would get this document, it would render it and stuff, but the server wouldn't really be involved. In order for anything to get back to the server, you would have to refresh the page. In other words, you would have to send another GET request and get another HTML document back. Now, what if you want to do a modern web application? What's the key thing you see in that? Is it's not static. And in fact, the data that is being shown to you by that web app is continuously changing. Does your entire page refresh every time you get a new email message in a modern web email client? No. When you scroll across the map, does the whole thing reload? No, it just smoothly moves. You can play. So this is the key change, is that you want, instead of this being send a URL, get back a document. I want to do request, response, request, response, request, response, while still being in the same document. And what this means is that you're really having this HTML document is no longer a document. It's a program. Fully autonomous program talking to a program on the... A program coming from here. So this is in the server. This is in the document. So when you visit Google Maps, you have downloaded a program that is running inside of your browser. When that program needs more data, it makes a connection. Well, it uses the established connection it has with the Google servers to request more data. And similarly, it can go the other way. Like, for example, in Gmail, new email just appears in your browser. It gets pushed from the server to your browser because your browser is maintaining a continuous connection with Google. This is not documents. This is programs talking to programs. The only thing is the program here in the browser is embedded inside of an HTML document that was loaded. So the real difference from classic client-server computation is the client is downloaded on the fly. You don't just have a program that you're running on your desktop or something that you then use to talk on the network. The program you want to run is being downloaded at the time of your request. And it comes down, and if it's a really big program, a little bit of it comes down, it does some work, and then more of it streams in the background while you do things. It's a fully distributed programming environment. Because people decided they wanted to do more with a web page than just have it be a web page. They wanted to make it a program. So if you're thinking about this for a little bit and you have any sort of inclination of security, you go like, wait, I'm downloading programs all the time from all kinds of places. You know, think about it. You visit your favorite blog, the link goes to like how many different web servers have you talked to? You know, hundreds, thousands a day, if you're sitting there surfing. All of these computers are sending programs to your computer that your computer then happily runs. Do you go around randomly downloading programs for your computer, like, you know, executables, and just installing them in Windows and seeing what they do? I sure hope not. If so, your computer is not going to run very well for very long, and you probably will not keep many secrets for very long. Watch your bank account just go up. How many of you have actually had your computer infected with some sort of malicious code? Like some sort of like thing that made it do all kinds of weird things that you know it was something? Wait, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, nothing wrong with saying you have. There's nothing compulsive. Frankly, I'd expect almost all of you to have had this happen. Say no. Probably you weren't paying attention. If you weren't running Windows. If you aren't running Windows, you probably haven't seen too much. Not to say there isn't malicious software out there, it's just most of it's for Windows. So why is this any different? Why are you not completely screwed by surfing the web? I mean, there are risks you run, but you're not completely screwed. Exactly. The browser does not allow the code that runs inside of it full access to your system. The code that runs inside of a browser is known as sandbox. And in fact, JavaScript was specifically designed to run in a way that would be safe. To run in a way that could not access everything on your computer. That it couldn't manipulate all the bits. It was isolated. Now, is that sandbox perfect? No. And in fact, the sandbox is a bit tricky now because how much of the information on any of your computers is really that valuable? Like, for example, I have my phone here. If my phone were to get, you know, destroyed or stolen, I mean, I'd be upset about losing the hardware. How quickly can I be back up and running with another identical piece of hardware? Pretty fast. Because I use online backups. I mostly access cloud services. So, I mean, if this thing goes away, I have another computer to access everything. My client is disposable for the most part, which is a big change from the classic desktop model, but that's the sort of thing web computing has enabled. But that means that the sandbox, everything I care about is actually inside my sandboxes. I don't really care if my device gets infected. I care about if my online accounts get compromised. You know, which is more damaging? How many of you use Gmail? So how do you feel about the Cmail accounts? Because those are Outlook accounts. Microsoft accounts.
I feel pretty bad at it since Ottawa U gets Gmail.
Does Ottawa U get Gmail? Oh, that's funny. But just in terms of the interface and things like, I mean, the Outlook client, I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, it's not a bad web app.
But to get to it, you have to log in through Carlton's portal. With Gmail, you just go to Gmail.
You can't log in through...
Oh, you can.
Oh.
You just probably specify at cmail.carlton.ca at the Hotmail.
Yeah.
You
used to have to log in from Outlook.com, but they block it now.
You can't?
You can't anymore.
You have to go to...
Okay, so you have to go to a slightly different URL. That doesn't seem like a huge problem. Actually, you know what that means? That actually is probably a good thing. Because that means that Carlton's data is probably not mixed in with everyone else's. And with Google's, it is all mixed in. They're all the same data set. So what does that mean? Well, it depends on how much you care about three-letter agencies accessing your stuff. Or how much you care about Canadian privacy laws applying to things. Sounds like Microsoft might actually have some better protections. I'll tell you one thing. I have to say I love a lot of the technology that Google puts out. And I do use quite a bit of it. But the thing you can never forget with Google is that you are not their customer. You're their product. Their customers are the advertisers. Customer is someone that pays you money to provide a service. That's what advertisers do to Google. With Microsoft, at least you're their customer for most of their stuff. No. You get licensed. Are they really good at their customer relation? No, but their monetary interests are kind of aligned in a different way than Google's is. So if Microsoft tomorrow decided to zero out all the money that came from advertising, Microsoft would go, sure. As long as they could make sure it was zeroed out for everyone else. They'd be perfectly happy. Their cash flow streams. Apple's exactly the same way. Google, you zero out the advertising income, they're dead. They have nothing. You know, that's almost... So just in terms of business model, there's an inherent creepiness to Google. Inherently. I mean, they have to track you and monitor you and monetize you. Same thing for Facebook. But anyway, but that's so. From the, but I was kind of, but so you so. But in general, you just don't like the usability of the Outlook interface.
I think it's just because it's different.
Because it's different. Yeah. I've looked at these things and it seems like they've got a very modern interface.
It works good on my phone.
Huh?
It looks better on my phone. It's more simpler.
Oh, the Outlook interface looks better on phone.
Yes, if I just go on.
Huh.
Any buttons or anything on it, just inbox and whatnot. I can't attach photos to it, but...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Because from what I looked at it, it looks like they're making it much more simple, and they're making it much more, less robust. I think it's based towards mobile devices, from what I use it.
Yes?
I'm not sure if they still have it at Outlook. They had it at Talk Now. You used to have advertising set up. email as well.
Right. But I don't think you have ads in the Carlton one. There shouldn't be any ads in the C-mail stuff because, you know, they're actually getting paid. So.
I use the Office 365
uh-huh.
with the C-mail when they originally were beta testing it and stuff uh-huh. like that there. So I went in and registered for all that. And it was really nice how it actually integrated all the documents and the Outlook.
Do you still have access to that now?
No, they canceled that.
So students have to individually subscribe to Office 365.
Business models. Anyway, one thing you should pay attention to when you use web applications is how well they work. Because the reasons why, you'll notice some of the best web applications seem to work like desktop applications, but it turns out the way they are implemented in order to get desktop-like functionality is very different. There's some things a lot of people say, but there's certain things that are very different. Like, for example, with Gmail. Gmail feels very responsive in general when you do email and stuff, right? But there's this basic problem here of this round trip time. The data is not resident in your browser. The email is not there. The email is resident on the server. Whatever you want to look at has to be here. But this connection takes time. In particular, it's high latency. So, this is a term you should understand in the web context because it matters a lot in the design of web applications. So there's bandwidth and there's latency. So I think the best way to understand bandwidth and latency is a simple metaphor. So think about a semi-truck full of hard drives going across Canada. Does that have high bandwidth? It is ridiculously huge bandwidth. You know, you've got like, 10,000, 2 terabyte hard drives sitting there inside of a semi-truck. Does it take a week to get across the country? Yes. But how long would it take for you to transmit that data over a fiber optic link? Probably longer than a week for, most reasonable connections. I mean, it's just massive volume of data. And so, this is a high bandwidth connection, but with also very high latency. So latency is about how long, when I make a request, how long does it take for me to get the first byte? Bandwidth is about how many bytes can I get per unit time. The web, nowadays our internet connections are relatively high bandwidth, but they are in general not low latency. You can get, you sit there and you start downloading an image or an ISO or a torrent or that, you can get a lot. But the time it takes for that first little bit of information is pretty long. It's, potentially at least tens, sometimes hundreds of milliseconds, sometimes seconds, depending on the kind of network congestion, before you get that first response, that first request. So what this says is, if Gmail was designed that every time you clicked on a new email message, it did a specific request to the server and then came back, it would feel very slow. It cannot do that, just because of the network architecture. But yet it feels like you click on it, the email's right there. How did it do that?
It already had a whole bunch of email that it downloaded to you, and then you click on the link, you're just bringing up something it already had.
So the answer is caching. Yes. In other words, the server doesn't send down just one email at a time. It says, oh, here's 50 emails. Here's 100 emails. Here's 200 emails. Here you go. It sends them all down to the browser. Are you going to look at all of them? Probably not, but they're there ready. But now Google has this little problem that if they just use this strategy indiscriminately, they'd suck up huge amounts of bandwidth. I mean, they already are pigs when it comes to bandwidth usage. But they can't just indiscriminately just send anything you possibly might want. So what do? They model you. They predict what you're going to do next. Built into Gmail is all kinds of user prediction code to see what action are you more likely to do? What data are you more likely to ask for next? And based on those models, it prefetches content. It guesses what email you're going to want to read before you click on it. Now, is it completely accurate? No. Sometimes you have to wait for things if you do kind of crazy things. But in general, it makes for a responsive application. So I find it very interesting that inherent in the web to make performance work well actually also ties into this notion of advertising, is of modeling people, predicting how they're going to behave. Whether it's inside Gmail or it's clicking on what are they going to buy, what advertiser to click on. Yes?
Well, wouldn't it sort of be more of like a personalization thing, as opposed to just advertising?
I'm saying is the basic technology has many uses. That's what I'm saying. It's things that are, you know, would slice many different ways. And it's not inherently good or evil, it just means that in using these applications, they learn a lot about you. Because they're constantly watching you and they're constantly modeling your behavior just in order for them to work well, let alone the revenue possibilities. Because if they can't predict what you're going to do, they cannot make your experience good. Yes?
Just thinking that Google does such a good job making your experience good in order to attract you as a product for your advertisers.
That's exactly
that. I don't really care being the product, because being a product works well on my end. I don't mind the advertisements they push at me, and the services that they offer to attract me, I like.
You're assuming that you're not being manipulated. So just in general with advertising, you have to always consider there are certain ways that, like, this stuff, a part of it, so have you ever noticed that when you bring your computer up from sleep, it'll come up and you'll see it, and it'll look like you see your desktop, but then you start trying to do things and nothing works for another 10, 15 seconds. Have you ever noticed that? It's because your computer's tricking you. What it actually puts up first is a screenshot. It's not really an active desktop. It's a screenshot of the last active state of your desktop. It puts that up to make you think that it came up fast while it's busy in the background trying to get things working. You'll find that responsive user interface design isn't about making things fast. It's about the user thinking it's fast. And there are all kinds of tricks that it pulls on you to make you do this. And once you see past them, it's very irritating. It's lying to you. And the same thing happens with sometimes with these web apps. They sometimes like make you think that it's responsive, but it's actually persuading you that something's happening. So the world of the web of web applications is this. Now, if you have looked at the web, how many of you have built a PHP-based application? Have you programmed PHP? Few of you. So if you look around, there is a lot of technologies that you'll see associated with web applications. I mean, first off, in the browser side, it's relatively straightforward. You've got your browser. And you have plugins. But plugins are mostly going away, because Apple said no to Flash for very good technical reasons and also for business reasons, and now everyone else is following their thing, and so plugins are mostly going away. But on the server side, what technologies do you have are things like PHP, Java servlets, you've got Apache, you've got, you know, there's this whole, you know, there's Rails. There's a whole bunch of these different technologies. If you go out there, you can, you know, and you can learn about them. And they're widely used. I could teach a lot of these things, but I specifically do not want to teach them in this class. Except at the very end, I'll talk about how these pieces fit together more once you've, you know, understood web applications better. But I don't want to talk about them because it's a mess.
And the reason it's a mess is because it all evolved.
What this is the result of is saying, oh, I'm going to take a system for delivering documents, and I'm going to incrementally change it into something for running programs. So, for example, when we talk about PHP, PHP is a programming language for running on the server. So you'd say, okay, if I'm running PHP on the server, I must have a program for running PHP. Not quite. What you have is a web server that's designed to serve files, like Apache. And you extend it with a module for doing PHP. Was Apache designed to run PHP? No. It was designed to serve files. But we've extended it with a PHP interpreter. So you have to learn. So in order to get this running, you have to get Apache working. And then you have to get PHP running on top. Is Apache doing most of the time nowadays much other than running PHP? No. And similarly, what was PHP originally designed for? It was designed to add a little bit of code to a web document. The entire syntax of PHP is saying, here's my HTML document, and here's a little bit of code inside the HTML document. But now what happens is, now it's little bit of HTML, code. Why do I need that? HTML, it's all PHP code. Well, I still got it embedded in the HTML document. You know, now, I mean, you could include things. But it's just the architecture of PHP was designed originally around, okay, we've got documents, and I want to make the documents dynamic. So instead of having, like, let's say there's 10 different files, you know, 10 different URLs I want to serve. It turns out what I want to serve for all those URLs is identical, except for one little thing. So instead of making 10 separate files, I'll have a little PHP program and a template, and it will fill in that little bit that changes and keep the rest the same. But as I've said, modern web applications have inverted this completely. So rather than teach you all of this legacy technology, which is really built around this notion of documents first, programs second, I thought it's better to teach you an environment where it's programs first, documents second. Did I say that right? I might have mixed that up. But so, you know, so it's because it's programs first, documents second. So then you say, okay, well, I'm going to program something on the server side, and then I'm going to program something on the client side. So what's a programming language going to do in the browser? JavaScript. Language of the web. It's kind of funny that it became the language of the web, considering it was developed at Netscape in like 10 days. Seriously, they had this really tight deadline. They said, we need to have a programming language in Netscape. We've got to have this, you know, language to allow us to do fancy menus and stuff. So build us a language. And so they put together this language really fast. And they came with JavaScript. And why is it named JavaScript? Because Java was hot. Does JavaScript have anything to do with Java? No. Not at all. Nothing. Completely separate. At every level, except they both look a bit like C. That's the only thing. But they look a bit like, but JavaScript, completely separate language. And so the lucky thing is JavaScript managed to get a number of very cool, advanced dynamic language concepts put into it. And that's part of why JavaScript's been able to survive for so long. But it's the first draft of a language. And it never really, I mean, there are definitely some corner cases and glitches that got built into it, which they're incrementally trying to fix, but they're still there. And that's the reason for the JavaScript, the good parts. Because if you look at the blemishes in JavaScript, it is ugly. I mean, it's a first draft. But there's a good language hiding in there. So I got to teach you JavaScript to be able to understand the browser. But now if I'm going to teach you web programming, you got to program something on the server too. So what language am I going to use there? Why not use the same language? That's why we're doing Node. Node.js is a JavaScript-based web server. Well, a JavaScript-based environment for writing web applications. So JavaScript on the server, JavaScript on the client. You might go, wait a second. JavaScript's this high-level, slow, ugly language. Wait, how can you, why would you want to use that in a server? Well, actually, it's neat. Yes, there are some ugly parts, but you can actually do some really nice programs in it. And it turns out you can run it pretty darn fast. And the reason why you can run it pretty darn fast is because of the war in the browsers. There has been increasing competition to make JavaScript faster in browsers in order to run all the fancy new web applications. And so what the Node folks said, wow, these things are getting really fast. Why don't I just take that same runtime engine and put it on the server? So that's exactly what Node is based off of. It is the Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine yanked out of Chrome and stuck on the server. And that's, now, you might go like, well, okay, so I'm learning JavaScript both places. Well, the key difference is the language is the same, but the data structures you have to access and the resources you have to access are very different. On the browser, you access something called the document object model. The DOM. Which is a programmatic representation of the document that was downloaded. This is the main thing that you do inside a web application when you're in the browser, is you're manipulating the DOM. This is how Gmail makes things scroll and make things, you know, windows appear and other things. It's manipulating the DOM. That's the data structure that it's messing with. There is no DOM on the server. What is there instead? Files, network connections, sockets, memory node. So this here on the server, it looks like a more classic kind of programming environment. It's not, see, this browser, it has to be heavily sandboxed. It can't access all the local resources, because if it did, you'd have a lot of security problems. But on the server, you've got to access all those things, because that's where all your data is stuff. So same language, but the programming environment is very different. So what we're going to do, actually, the server-side environment is actually much simpler because it's more like the environments you're used to. So we're going to learn this first, which means JavaScript running on the server. And then we'll learn JavaScript running on the client in the browser. Make sense? So, last thing we'll try talking about is this piece missing from this picture. Yes?
So, to get, make sure it's clear, is it like two programs talking to each other?
Exactly. It happens to be that the program on the server actually sent a program to here that it then talks to. This server running JavaScript puts together a little HTML document with JavaScript in it that's then sent here, that runs, and that JavaScript now talks to that JavaScript. Now, there's a little tricky part of this, which is that you say, well, my code's running here, my code's running here, so I can trust them, right?
You can't trust the guys in between.
Well, not just that. You can't trust this guy here either. You don't know what's happening in the browser. It means any code you send over here to the server, to the client, you should assume it can be arbitrarily changed and modified and sabotaged. It keeps no secrets. You cannot trust its integrity at all. It is interface. It is convenience. It is not trustworthy at all. If you're running a web application, the only stuff you can really trust is stuff running on the server. And this is actually one of the reasons why, you know, web applications are tricky from a security point of view, is that you're downloading code here. Like, let's say you have some data structure. Here's a classic one. An old e-commerce shopping cart program had the shopping cart on the browser in such a way that the prices were inside of a form, which meant that you had something for $100, you could change it to 1 cent. In the browser, and then send it to the server, and the server believed the price. So you could, you know, just change the prices, send it here, and your purchase, and it said, okay, 1 cent, sure. So
And, you know, yeah, that was using forms, but it applies for anything that's running in the browser. You can't trust this code. So any data that's sent to the server has to be appropriately validated. Like, whenever you're in the browser, it checks, like, says, oh, you didn't type that in right. There's this mistake, that mistake, and stuff. That same thing has to also happen on the server. This is for the user's convenience. That side is for security. So, I've left out one very important piece of this puzzle. Anyone know what that piece is?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. The database. So in this evolution of the web application, first, the data store behind a web server was files. But then they realized, wait, files aren't enough. I need to do complex queries. I need to organize my information. I need to sort it. I need to be able to retrieve and access and modify small bits of information from multiple things. I have to deal with concurrency. I have to deal with multiple requests coming at the same time. How do I deal with all these things? And they realized the best way to do this was doing the same sort of technology that was originally developed for handling airline reservations, i.e. a relational database. So we're going to talk more about what a database is and why it makes sense to use in the context of a web application. But the main thing to think about from this perspective is it's the persistent data structures for this. The web servers are actually kind of ephemeral, not quite in the same way as the browser, but in many ways similarly, because you don't, in a large website, you don't run just one web server. You run many web servers. You want to have them be replicated. Some of them will go up and down and stuff. You can't count on them actually maintaining any state. So instead, that state, like, for example, your email, your login information, all of your personal information for any web application, it's not stored in this program that's running on the server. It's stored in a database that is queried as needed. And there's different technologies used for structuring the database so that it can be highly available and robust and fault-tolerant and whatever. But the nice thing is that a lot of the things a web application serves is actually static content, things like images and other things, stuff that's the same for everyone, that can all be cached, that can all be replicated, sent out in various different ways. So that part doesn't have to be in the database. The database is just for the stuff that changes frequently. Now, the browser should just talk to the database then, right? I've got my email here, my Gmail email client. Should that just talk to the database and grab my email? Why do I have a stupid web server in the middle? So this is a middleman.
You want to stop people who want to do bad things from using the browser directly?
So the equivalent of giving someone direct access to your database is giving someone direct access to all the data structures of your application. Is that a good idea?
No.
The database typically has some amount of protections, but the way databases are, it's very hard to map the kind of protections they provide to the kind of protections you want to provide here. So really what these... In a lot of ways, what these web server applications end up being is a translation layer for the database. It's the logic for deciding how do you take a request from the user and convert it into the right form to make the appropriate queries in the database, but not make the wrong ones. So, what you should get the idea is that the actual computational work done on the server isn't actually that much. In a real web application, things happening on the client can be very computationally intensive. You might want to be doing graphics and stuff, and that's all being more supported. The database, crunching all the data, indexing, and stuff, that can be kind of intensive. But the actual web server is really more just to push things around. It's there to be responsive. Its main job is to have low latency. It's about low latency access to things. It needs to be responsive. It means when the client comes in with a request, it needs to send back a response as quickly as possible. It's not supposed to sit there and churn through things. That's the job of other things that you run in the back end. So this actually gives rise to how the JavaScript is structured on the server, which actually mirrors how it's structured on the client. The last thing I'll talk about here, which is callbacks. So one thing you have to deal with very early on when you're doing web applications is this notion of concurrency. It's not just one user accessing your web application. It's potentially 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, a million. You don't know how many, but they're all accessing it at different stages. And worst of all, they're all accessing it in this really weird interleaved way, and the only way the server sees them is through these URLs. HTTP was designed to be a stateless protocol. It's not like something like SSH, where you connect to it and now, oh, I am logged in. There is no notion of being logged in HTTP. That is a concept that is added on top. And that actually has had very nice scaling properties for the web.
But you don't log in. So because of the statelessness, you have to, at the server side, every UL coming in, you have to figure out, okay, what is this URL for? Which application? Which user? It has to interpret that URL, figure out its context based on the other things the browser sent in, and then decide what to do. And it needs to do this while lots of other things, other requests are also coming in. So what sort of architecture do you have for that? Every time a request comes in, you have to do some computation, and then you have to send the response out. Now, the classic Unix way of doing this was you would create you'd fork off another copy of the process. So an entire new running copy of the program would be created for every response coming in. It works. It's actually relatively easy to program. It's very heavyweight. What's the more modern way of doing things? Well, instead of making an entire copy of the program, you make, so either go with processes, or you're multi-threaded. Start a new thread. So instead of copying all of memory, you just make a new execution context. We'll talk about this more later too. This is really an overview of a lot of stuff. You make a new execution context. The trouble with creating threads is, again, it's actually heavier weight than you want. It's not maximally efficient. So instead, what you do with something like Node.js is it's single-threaded. There is no multiple threads coming in the response. But what it does is, as each response comes in, it processes it just really quickly, and if there's more work to be done, it sets it aside. And then takes another thing in, and then lets that other stuff go on in the background, and when it finishes, it then serves it up. So what it's doing is something known as asynchronous. So callbacks implies asynchronous I.O. So this means every time, you never block for an operation. In normal programming that you've all seen, when you try to read a file, you do a read. And then the next statement after the read, you expect the data to have arrived. Correct? But the problem is, in reality, getting that data from disk or from any other sort or from the network or whatever took a long time computationally. If that was all the computer was doing, it'd be twiddling its thumbs. It would be doing nothing at all for potentially thousands of instructions while it was waiting for that data to come in. So what you do, instead of having it wait, it just says, okay, I've made a request to read, and then I'm going to go do something else. I don't know when the data is going to be read, but here is a program to run when the data comes back. That's what the callback is. It's saying, here is some code, do this,
when this condition is met. Go read the file for me. When the file is read, here, do this. Go write this to a file. When you finish writing it, I need to do something else, so run this program. It's a different way of thinking about programming, but it fits in with this whole low latency, highly responsive design you need for web applications, because you have to be very aware of what takes time to process and what doesn't. And what is slow is input and output, not computation. Computation is relatively very fast. And so what you will be noticing is when we program on the server in Node.js is you will be doing callbacks up the wazoo. And I will be helping with you with that structure. And now that I think I've stuffed your brains with enough content, I will stop there. So please come Wednesday, talk to Annie, and Friday there'll be another lab. And if you haven't finished this lab, the one before, do it and go to the TA office hour. Although Michael will not be here this week either. He's in New York.